and the sky went black. Tales and history of a longbow with Henrik Armstad and Adam Westlund. This episode of the podcast And the Sky Went Black will deal with majorly two battles, the Battle of Crecy and the Battle of Agincourt. Welcome, Adam Westlund.
Thank you.
Once again, we sit here. How did it feel the last time? Was it okay?
Felt quite good, I think.
Right. Now we venture forth into those two famous battles. Why are we interested in those battles?
I would say that we've chosen them primarily because they are two famous victories of the longbow, and they are quite far apart. One is in the golden age of longbow shooting, and the other one is more at the end of the longbow's reign.
In Europe. That's right. And we're talking about the Hundred Years' War now between England and France, right?
Yes, absolutely.
What was that war?
The Hundred Years' War is not a war in the modern sense. It's not like the Second World War where you have continuous fighting over this period of time, but it's rather a long series of conflicts between French and English kings taking place between 1337 and 1453, so it's actually 116 years, but we usually call it the Hundred Years' War. And it's usually summarized as being a conflict in which the English kings try to take control of the French crown, and they ultimately fail to achieve that.
So the French won that war.
You could say so. It depends on how you define won, but yes, I would probably say so.
On the 26th of August in 1346, the French and the English armies meet close to a village called Crecy.
Yes.
And this is the beginning of the Battle of Crecy, one of military history's most famous battles,
yes,
by the way. The Hundred Years' Wars haven't been going on for that long at this point.
No, exactly. Right? This is at the very beginning, and the core conflict that started the Hundred Years' War, no one of course knew that it was the Hundred Years' War at the time, but the core conflict was still very fresh. So when Charles IV of France died, Edward III, King of England, was the closest male kinsman. So he would be the heir to the throne of France, but the French felt threatened that the English king would inherit the French throne, and a French court ruled that Philip of Valois in France instead would be the new king. And first Edward accepted this. He didn't really like it, but he accepted it. But Edward was also the Duke of Aquitaine, which is a French region, since the English kings came from French ancestry.
So he was a French prince.
Basically.
Yes.
But his family had been living in England for a long time. But so this became a problem because Edward was the king of England, Philip was the king of France, but Edward was also supposed to be Philip's vassal, being the Duke of Aquitaine. And the conflict between them grew, and it ended in a confiscation by the French crown of the Duchy of Aquitaine. So Philip took Aquitaine in 1337, and this is what started the Hundred Years' War.
And he was, of course, outraged.
Yes, as kings usually are.
But one can remind the audience that at this time we didn't have territorial states.
No.
As we did later in pre-modern times, early modern period. So basically, a country was somewhere where you acknowledged your allegiance to a certain prince.
Exactly.
And that could change rather abruptly.
Exactly. And the sense of nationality is much, much weaker. And also, you have a state primarily based on personal bonds. We have a German historian called Gerd Althoff, who has talked about the Personenverbandstaat, the state of personal bonds.
Yes.
So people are very important in this, and what you talk about, the later forms of statehood have not been created yet.
So for us living in modern nation states, this sounds very strange, but to a medieval person, it wasn't, basically. Anyway, the Battle of Crecy.
Yeah.
1346.
Hmm?
What happened?
Well, so Edward, King of England, Edward III, he had landed in France for a second time. He had been there before in 1340, but he landed in 1346 and he plundered in Normandy, in Caen, for example. Then he crossed the River Seine. We don't know for sure what his intentions were, but some people claim that he was aiming for Paris. And a French army was mustered. They started hunting the English army, and the English army retreated towards the River Somme. They probably wanted to cross over it to reach their allies in Flanders, in today's Belgium. They managed to cross the Somme at a place called Blanche Tacque to beat their way through, and the French followed because they didn't want Edward's army to escape France. And they caught up with them, and Edward realized that this would happen, so he chose a strategic place to defend against the French army. And this was a hill close to the village of Crécy-en-Ponthieu. This was a strategic place because it had a very steep slope. So the French knights, because there were many knights in the French army, would have to charge up the slope. Mm. Also, he had a stream on one side, and he also had two villages guarding his two flanks.
Right,
so it
right.
was very hard to come around. So this was a very good place to defend. So he,
exactly. If you stop for just a moment. So basically, you have two different... You have two armies, which are roughly equal in size. Are French much bigger?
Well, the French is slightly bigger. As always, when it comes to medieval numbers, we can't trust the sources. But most people... Most historians think that the English army was somewhere around 15,000 men, and the French was maybe, it was larger, was maybe around 30,000, so roughly double size.
Oh, but, that's quite a difference.
Yes.
So, much larger French army, we recognize this from later battles.
Yes.
And the two armies are different. We have one army, the French, being mainly consisting of mounted cavalry?
Yes. Well, maybe not mainly. We don't know how many infantrymen they had, actually.
Right.
But we usually say that there were around 10 to 12,000 knights and men-at-arms who were riders armed as knights, with wearing plate mail, riding horses. And in the English army, maybe you had around 2,500. So there was a huge difference when it came to knights and other soldiers with that sort of armament.
You spoke about the English taking a defensive position.
Yes.
So we also see two different tactics here.
Yes.
One being defensive and one being offensive. This is like tanks driving towards anti-tank guns. This is like First World War infantry attacking machine guns.
In a way.
Whatever, anachronistic.
but
we have two different tactics.
Yes.
How did those two different tactics come about?
You mean how they had evolved?
Yes, it's the same time. Mm-hmm. They're both European princes.
Yeah, yeah,
and
absolutely.
You do war in this way, where you have chivalry. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to be a warrior like this and that.
Yeah.
And yet we see two different armies.
Well, we see a development of chivalry, as you say, with heavily armed knights being the primary weapon or the primary tool for winning battles in Europe for several hundreds of years. And they had been so since around the year 1000. The side with most knights usually won. But the English had a very hard time competing with France, with a much larger population, many more noblemen, and therefore they had gone in a different direction. A very large part of their force consisted of longbowmen, and this, of course...
That's why we're here.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, right.
And since they used longbowmen at the core of their army, they wanted to shoot as many arrows as possible before battle was joined. So therefore, it was logical to take a defensive position and be able to fire as much as possible at the opposing foe.
I see. So there you have it. Two different tactics, two different kinds of armies, two European princes. They are both kings, right?
Yes. The King of England and the King of France.
Standing there. And what actually happens? Do the French do as they're supposed to do? They charge? Or is there something... There are crossbowmen,
yes,
right?
Exactly. So this is the first step. So the English have somewhere between 5 and 7,000 longbowmen. We don't know for sure. They are placed on the hill. And On the other side, the French had, fairly sure that they had 6,000 crossbowmen. So the numbers have roughly equal.
And they're from Genovese, right?
Yeah, exactly. They're from northern Italy.
They're
mercenaries. They're paid.
Right.
And they are extremely skilled mercenaries.
Right.
They have been in many battles. They know what they're doing. They have pavises, which are large shields that are carried with them to protect them from
bow fire,
for example.
Yes. So basically we have Genovese mercenary crossbowmen.
Yes.
Facing English longbowmen.
Yeah.
So this is like the classic for us being interested in long distance weaponry during this medieval period. This is like a classic situation.
The longbow versus the crossbow.
The longbow versus the crossbow.
Yes.
The foreign mercenary versus the true English.
Yes.
Well, it's been interpreted in that way.
I see
in nationalistic
mean.
Discourse.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it also goes as it's supposed to go. The crossbowman loses this standoff between the English longbow and the crossbow.
Mm.
Why do they lose?
You could say that there are basically two ways to interpret this. On the one hand, some people interpret it based on the superiority of the longbow or the superiority of the longbowmen. So they want to claim that the longbow, since it has had a slightly larger range, a longer range, they had the upper hand, and they could shoot much faster than the crossbowmen, that they actually just outshot them.
Right.
While the other side usually talks about the specific circumstances of the battle, and here we have several things to go on.
It was raining.
Yes, it had been raining, and the English had camped there on the hill for a while, so they had a better possibility to take off their bowstrings, while the French had been marching to the battle. Some people claim that it seemed that the Genovese mercenaries had failed to take off the strings from their crossbows, so they were wet, less efficient than normally.
Are you supposed to take off a string of a crossbow?
Usually you can, but maybe not if you're close to a battle. Usually you have several. You could put on a new one, because if it breaks, otherwise your weapon would be worthless.
Mm.
But other people have claimed that the English were rested, the French were tired. The English were standing on a hill, and the French were standing on lower ground, which made the difference in range much more drastic. So some people claim that the circumstances made the English superior. Some people have pointed to the weapon and the users.
Right. We have some sources from this actual battle.
Mm-hmm.
And as I understand it, the crossbowmen's arrows cannot reach the English longbow.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yeah. We don't know for sure, of course, but one of the sources claims that the bolts from the crossbows fall short trying to reach the longbowmen on the hill when they fire back. This is hard to say whether this was the case all over, and then why. Had they placed themselves wrong, or was it wet strings, or what was the reason for this? But we do know that the English longbowmen inflicted considerable damage on the Genovese mercenaries, and they failed to inflict that damage back, so the crossbowmen started retreating.
And then, according to myth, legend, or true sources, I don't know, but the French knights say basically, get rid of riffraff mercenaries and kill the crossbowmen.
Well, most sources claim that the French knights got tired of the Genovese crossbowmen and charged through them to get up the hill. I think it's only one source claiming that they actually started cutting them down, and I would say that it's probably more likely that maybe someone struck someone, but I think it would be... I don't believe that there was a mass killing of very expensive mercenaries.
Exactly. They're worth a lot of money.
I don't believe in that, but I think that maybe someone was killed or there was a fight or something like that, and this gave way to this.
Anyway, there was some notion of among the French chivalry that let's not use those crossbow men.
Let's trust in our own strength.
So basically, they charge up the hill.
Yes.
Right. Both mounted knights and, I guess, men-at-arms.
Yeah, but primarily mounted knights,
right?
Because they would move at a much faster pace, and it would be hard. The plan was that they would charge up the hill, and then you would move the infantry up behind them. The infantry came in waves afterwards, and the idea was that the heavy cavalry would break the English line, and then you could take care of the rest. So it was supposed to be the hammer in the tactic.
As I understand it, in 1346, we're still mostly talking about chainmail armor, even on the knights. Not plate armor.
This is exactly around the time when some people start getting cuirasses. That it's very, very modern if you have a breastplate covering your torso. But most people have plate mail on their knees. They maybe have it on their feet. They have it on their elbows and so on. And they have an aceton, a coat of arms, or a thick coat under chainmail. That's right. What most people... most knights or men-at-arms use for protection.
So they looked good as well as...
Yeah, but the aceton was beneath, and then you had the coat of arms on top. So you had many layers.
Yes. But as we ourselves has tried in Sagittarholme, we tried shooting with needlepoint arrowheads.
Yes.
Towards chainmail and what you call it?
An aceton.
Right. Yeah. And it pierces it.
Yes.
Quite easily.
Yeah. Especially from a short distance.
Especially from a short distance, but I could, maybe yeah. maybe
it could forward, absolutely yes. pierce even from longer distance.
So those French knights, mounted knights, they don't do very well, do they?
No, they are beaten back because many of them are shot. Some of the others had their horses shot, and they fall off in the middle. Then you have many waves of cavalry, of course, because you can't charge 10,000 men up a hill at the same time. That only happens in Peter Jackson movies.
Oh, I love those movies.
So basically, you have several waves of cavalry coming up the hill, and when people fall off or are stopped short, when they actually reach the English lines, they get in the way of the next wave of cavalry coming up the hill. So they fail, and they retreat, and then they try the tactic again. And they fail, and they try again, and they fail, and they try again. Most sources count to 16 French charges up the hill. None of them succeeds. Of course, it puts a strain on the English line, because in the long run, even if you fire for all you're worth, it's hard holding back against this wave of steel continuously coming up the hill.
Right.
But basically, every time some of the French knights get there, you also have English infantry, and you have knights and their retainers who are fighting on foot. They're not fighting mounted.
And people die, which is kind of unusual.
Yes.
In battles.
Yeah.
They die a lot, don't they?
Yeah, it's quite bloody. We don't know for sure, but some historians would claim that almost half of the French army died or was taken prisoner. So many thousands dead, at least, which is quite uncommon. And most of them either died in the continuous longbow fire, or they die at the stakes, the sharpened stakes that the English have put up, and they're defending against behind these stakes when the French actually get through with a few men. And here you also have the Black Prince, Edward, the Crown Prince of England, leading the defenders. So he's sort of a war hero in English.
The Black Prince continues to use the longbow.
Exactly. Yes. So because he fought alongside the longbowmen here, and he was one of those that held back the French when they actually got through with some men.
Right. So at what point during this battle do the French, I guess, understand that we have been beaten?
Basically, it is very late, since they actually do 16 large charges up the hill. But at the very end, when they have a few very symbolic, what we call failures, or symbolic losses, you could say. First of all, the French had a mythical standard, the banner of the king, called the Oriflamme, and it was supposed that French kings wielding that banner, or carrying that banner, could not lose a battle.
Right.
And the Oriflamme was lost to the
invisible.
English. Yeah.
Yes. Invincible.
Invincible, yes. Not invisible. No. That would have been very effective on a medieval battlefield. Yeah. But
maybe they wanted to be when losing.
Yeah, exactly.
But we have several the cross of Christ during
exactly.
Crusades.
Yeah, the first crusade and so on. So
it didn't work.
No, the Oriflamme was lost to the English, and that was, of course, that felt very bad.
Yes, I was thinking about it, because those knights have more or less been used to winning battles for a couple of hundred years.
Yes.
And now suddenly they lose.
Suddenly nothing works anymore.
Exactly. They're charging towards peasants, or whatever you would have called yeomen, English archers.
Yeah.
So did this, the result of this battle, did it in some way affect Europe's chivalrous tradition socially, culturally, politically?
That is very hard to say, because the problem, I would say, is that the impact of this battle on those structures that you're talking about, social structures, is sort of obscured by the fact that only two, three years later, the Black Death strikes Europe and everything has changed.
Right, moving along. Because this is in 1346, right?
Yes.
Which is still the sort of the height of medieval, what do you call it in English?
We usually say that the High Middle Ages end with the Black Death in 1350, and the Late Middle Ages begin.
Exactly. So, much changes.
Yes.
Now, the Black Death has been slightly exaggerated, but it was an instance where Europe changed that way.
And it had an enormous impact on social structures, definitely.
Exactly. And so this affects the French. They're not able to produce as many mountain knights before, as I understand it. But you would say that it more affects the English than the French.
Yeah, I would say that since the problem is that mountain knights can usually escape the Black Death better, I would say. And also...
How?
Because they're richer. They can travel away from the disease, or they can try to isolate themselves better. Or also, since France is so much bigger, you have a larger population to draw troops from than England.
Right, so if a million Frenchmen dies, it doesn't affect the French.
While a million Englishmen would be a bigger problem.
Right, right.
We have an example here in Scandinavia with the Kingdom of Norway being basically broken by the Black Death, and they were not an independent kingdom for 600 years almost after that.
Mm-hmm. So the English ability to wage war in France lessens.
Yes.
From 1349, 1350, and so on and so forth. But we also see strategic changes in the French armed forces concerning how to handle the English army, right?
Yes. The main change was that they did not seek out these large pitched battles anymore, because they would rather go for attrition. They would follow the English armies along and hope that field diseases like dysentery and other such things would do their work for them, and they would have a larger pool to draw from, because they would of course also be affected by these things. But they would try to avoid open battle as much as they could.
This is quite interesting. There was someone called Bertrand du Guesclin.
Yes.
Under the direction of Charles V. And he's more or less formulated this strategy, which was seen as unchivalrous, cowardice. It was quite criticized, as I understand it, by some pieces of the French nobility. For instance, there's one example where they're trying to attack a fortress with this sort of cowardly methods, and there are French noble refused to lead the men in the attack because the manner in which they gained entrance was not chivalrous.
Mm.
But still, it was a success.
Yes, you can say that there's an irony to this, because in a way, this is a strategy that kings throughout the entire Middle Ages wanted to use, because it was too much of a chance to face the enemy in open battle.
Right.
And this was true even after the Middle Ages. Most of the time in for example, the 17th Thirty Years' War.
17th
century,
yes.
And,
do battle.
Exactly. You don't want to do battle. You only do it when it's better to risk everything than to just remain and do nothing. And we have, for example, many medieval battles being fought in October, when one side wants to gain access to a very important stronghold that where they want to stay over the winter. The ironic thing is that even though the battlefield tactics or the strategy in a broader sense becomes more and more, as your source would claim, cowardly. At the same time, this is actually when the ideology of chivalry grows stronger and stronger, because it's not during the High Middle Ages, where the mounted knight is at his peak, that his ideology is at its peak.
Right.
So you have two
different...
You have
to question it for it to flourish.
Exactly. So you have two different movements. You have one being very idealistically chivalrous, and one movement being much more pragmatic and criticizing the nobility. So you have a very dynamic 14th century with a fierce debate concerning these matters.
That's
in Europe.
It connects to Foucault, who somewhere says that you cannot have power without resistance to power. So
no.
When it's being questioned. After 1360, the English would rarely again see the successes that they have achieved in the first half of 100 years.
Yes.
So what happens to the English? Do they sort of resign and they go, oh no, we're not facing our longbow archers anymore, what should we do?
No, but gradually they reformulate their strategy as well. So, but this takes a long time. In the time of Edward III, the strategy was mostly that you marched in long sweeps across French territory and you took key strongholds or key towns in different places to annoy and force the French to negotiate, to put them in a bad position, make them hunt you, and so on.
Mm.
But gradually, the English start reformulating their strategy too, and this mainly takes place closer to our second battle of Agincourt or Azincourt, where this has completely changed. Now, in the beginning of the 15th century, the English instead try to conquer land gradually to expand the English holdings in France. Before, you did not expand from the holdings you had. You marched deep into French territory. You took one town, you marched out, you took a daring detour somewhere to threaten. Now you work much more gradually and much more methodically in a way that is more, that is a bit more like modern warfare.
Right.
We think about fronts and things like these.
And there are also other changes. For instance, plate armor now,
yes,
becomes much,
exactly,
more common. And being a longbow archer myself, as you are, we know that it's much harder to penetrate plate armor.
Much harder.
You can do it,
yes,
under the right circumstances, but it's the ease of penetrating chainmail,
yeah,
which
is nowhere near
that. Ridiculous.
Yes.
To compare the two.
Yes.
And some military historians has put their emphasis on the development of plate armor.
Mm.
What would you say?
I would say that this is indeed very important, and you can see that plate armor quickly becomes very, very popular. So when the armorsmiths start creating these plate armors, they become dominant on medieval battlefields, or on 15th century battlefields. Knights and men-at-arms, who are riders mounted as knights, usually paid for by the knights themselves, they start wearing more and more plate armor until in the mid-15th century, the knight is almost completely covered in plate mail. Most.
Right, and that's how we, in popular culture today, look at one thing of a knight, which is completely
covered. But that was actually for the dying moments of the knight's history,
yes,
you could say.
Manufacturing plate armor was complicated. It was quite expensive,
mm-hmm,
but they were very effective, and they were very light, and
exactly,
you could do somersaults in them, and
yeah,
whatever.
Many people today...
Why would you do that? I don't know, but people always mention it.
Yes, yes. Many people today have the image that... This is something that I encounter a lot when I talk about medieval armors, is that people think that if you fall off your horse, you're lying like a turtle upside down.
And you need a
and
crane
you, yeah,
to
you
put
need a
you
crane
on.
To lift you onto the horse from the beginning. This is not true at all. 15th century suits of armor usually weighed between 25 and 30 kilos, and that weight was spread over your entire body. The knight was usually a very well-trained man, since he didn't need to work. He could put most of his time into military training. So he was used to walking and running and riding, especially riding, around with wearing his armor. So as you say, you could do somersaults, and that's actually something that we face in fighting manuals from this period. they show how knights trained, and they wanted to be able to do these very agile movements to be able to use that mobility on the battlefield.
Everybody was kung fu fighting.
well,
you always get an image of Matrix here. But anyway, plate armor, very effective, although very expensive, of course.
Yes.
And it took several specialists to manufacture plate armor to do different things. And they had their weak spots, the joints, right?
Yeah.
Where if you're able to be a skilled archer, you can shoot at specific points.
It depends on how close the enemy is, of course. If you're shooting from a distance, you're not aiming at a specific person even. But if you shoot enough arrows, there's a good chance that one of them hits a joint. Also, so there are a few weak points. But the weak points also get fewer and fewer because the weapon smiths and the armor smiths compete. And the armor smiths listen to the complaints of their customers, of course, and try to come up with new ways to defend against the injuries usually suffered by the knights. So the plate armors get better and better, but also slightly heavier during this period.
So we get this, at least at long ranges, longbow archers are not anymore that deadly towards mountain knights, but they can still do something about the horses.
Exactly.
Right.
So it's not completely meaningless to hit the knight, of course.
Right.
You can be lucky to hit a joint. You can also, the arrow strikes very hard, so there's a risk that you fall off still, or that you get severely beaten under your plate armor, because there's a huge impact when these war bows hit you, when shots from the war bows. But as you said, you can also kill the horse. So we know that some arrows were specifically designed to pierce horse flesh. This also results in armorsmiths coming up with more and more sophisticated suits of horse armor to protect the horses as well, especially their backs, since the arrows come falling from above.
Right. So we have some sort of arms race here.
Yes.
The Battle of Agincourt.
Yes.
The last victory
of the longbow.
Of the longbow. And also maybe the most glorious victory of longbow. Me, myself, I was at the 600 years anniversary, celebrated in London by our dear friends of the Fraternity of St. George.
Yes.
It was a wonderful experience. The English should not be able to get that victory of Agincourt.
No.
It is Crécy repeated, and the French should have known better. At Agincourt in 1450. This is almost 100 years after Crécy, right?
At least 75 or so.
Yes,
yeah.
More or less.
Yeah.
Right.
60.
And still, it is the same story all over again, except that there are no Genoese crossbowmen this time. Surely they may be there somewhere. You can tell me. But anyway, this is the classic situation of chivalry, knights on one side and longbowmen on the other side.
Yes.
How can this be repeated almost 100 years later?
Well, there are many ways to answer this question. First of all, in a way, they're similar, Crécy and Agincourt, but there are also many differences to them. And as you say, it's much more unlikely that the English will win at Agincourt than at Crécy, I would say. Because the French had faced these longbow armies for a long time. They had usually tried to avoid them, as we talked about, but they were also less afraid of them on the battlefield because they had won smaller victories against longbow-based armies.
And they had plate armor.
Yeah, they had plate armor. So this was, of course, part of why they felt better protected. But we have a very similar movement on the map because the new King of England, Henry V, he also marches into France, he crosses the River Seine, he goes up towards the Somme, he wants to cross the Somme at the same place at Blanchetac as Edward did in 1346.
Oh, so he knows his history.
Yes, but he can't. That ford is too well protected now. So he moves along the Somme to the southeast, and the French are shadowing him, the French army. A major difference here is that the French army does not have a king as its leader now, because France is in complete political turmoil.
Yes. Huge turmoil, right?
Huge turmoil. It's
civil war.
It's civil war between the Armagnac and the Burgundy sides. We usually call them that. And we won't go into all the backstory, no. But basically the French army is led by a committee of noblemen. It's not obvious who is at the top.
But there is this constable, right?
Yes.
Yes.
But
which is supposed to be the...
Yeah, but he does not have absolute power. He does not have a chain of command under him like the one Henry has. So the French battle plan, shortly before the actual battle, is actually created by a committee of noblemen. They're discussing and they're arguing and debating, and then they come up with a battle plan.
But they're competent people, right? They're professional warriors.
Yeah,
they are competent people.
Yeah. The problem here is also partly chivalry, because since you have this civil war situation and you have the ideology of chivalry, no one wants to be seen as a weakling.
Ah, so the successful strategy, yeah, of avoiding battle and
exactly,
war attrition is not a plausible thing to say at those meetings, because you want to show off as a courageous warrior.
Exactly. Also, since France is in such turmoil, they are seeing Henry as a considerable threat. That's the reason why the civil war has taken a temporary pause at the moment, to create this dream team army to beat back.
Well, wouldn't one side of the civil war, maybe we can ally with Henry instead?
Yes, both sides actually. So we have a situation both before and especially after the Battle of Agincourt, where both of the sides in the French civil war negotiate with each other, both negotiate with the English at the same time, so there's an interesting and intricate political process going on here. But maybe we should get into that when
we're actually
done with the fighting.
Eventually, the two armies meet
exactly
at Agincourt.
Yes, and Henry is also going northwards again, just like Edward was going towards Flanders, Henry is going towards the English safe haven of Calais.
Right, because Henry isn't very happy at this moment. Things are not going as well as he would have hoped.
He has taken the port of Harfleur, but he has lost more men in the process than he counted on, and it also took much longer than he counted on. His original army probably was around 12,000, but this has shrunk to somewhere between 6,000 and 7,000, probably. We don't know for sure. This much larger French force, probably, is chasing him, and he sees he needs to pull back, but he also wants to march from Harfleur to Calais, which has been English since the aftermath of the Battle of Crecy, actually, which is, it's an important English stronghold on French territory, or
right,
what we consider French territory.
What I never understood was, why doesn't he go back? Why doesn't he has this? It's taken this city after a long siege, and it was quite an unsuccessful siege, but finally they gave in.
Yeah.
Why not just, let's go back, guys, and take the boats home.
Well, in the 1360s, the English kings had given up claims on the French throne, but Henry had invoked that right again. I am the rightful king of France.
Yes, we've all seen the Shakespeare play.
And I will take the throne of France. Would be seen as a much bigger failure than to retreat after only having taken one coastal city. But if he hadn't made that boast, it would have been seen, well, we took Harfleur, now we can go home. Mm. But now a march from Harfleur to Calais shows that he can move freely across the French territory that is rightly his.
I understand. So, here's the battle. The French army on one side, and the English army on the other side.
Yeah, the French are blocking the English way to Calais.
Exactly. And on both sides of the battlefield, there are forests.
Yeah, you have woods on both sides, yes.
So basically, the French plan is to wait for the English to attack, because they don't want to attack themselves towards the English longbow.
They've learned the lesson.
They learned the lesson well, those cunning French people.
You didn't say frogs, at least.
No, I didn't. A standstill. Nothing happens, basically. So what happens?
Yes.
Well, nothing happens.
Because Henry also knows, of course, that since his army is made up primarily of longbow archers, probably around 5 longbow archers to every infantryman, he does not want to attack either. He has to break his way through, but he doesn't want to attack. This is, of course, a dilemma. And the French know this, so they just wait, because they don't want to charge into Henry's pointed stakes and face the Longbow fire. What happens is that Henry, who had told his army to fasten these stakes in between the two forests, the one of Azincourt and Tramcourt, probably, he tells his men to dig out these stakes to move forward and re-emplace them further forward to try to lure the French in.
And they start firing his longbowmen.
Yeah, they walk forward, they start firing.
They start to hit the French.
Yeah, they start firing on the French. Here is where things take a considerably different turn than in Crécy. Because in Crécy, they started with sending forward the crossbowmen.
Right.
And they do have crossbowmen. They have archers as well. The French crossbowmen and archers together are actually more numerous than the English longbow archers.
They outnumber the English.
Even when it only comes to distance weapons, they outnumber them. But they are at the rear. No one knows why. I don't know. Maybe it was the failure at Crécy still. No, I probably not. But they are at the rear.
Sounds
this time.
More like some sort of chivalrous notion of
perhaps,
we're going to charge.
Especially since you don't have a single commander making strategic decisions, but rather many noblemen boasting to each other. And we even have accounts of noblemen who so desperately want to fight in the front ranks to gain the glory that they leave their own men further back without a proper leader because they need to fight in front with the other knights even though they should be leading their own men. So the chain of command breaks down.
And this has of course been given to humanity via the famous play by William Shakespeare, which was written in 1600, which is quite late. In this play, King Henry V makes the following speech to his men.
This story shall the good man teach his son, and Crispin Crispian shall ne'er go by from this day to the ending of the world, but we in it shall be remembered. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers, for he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother. Be he ne'er so vile, this day shall gentle his condition. And gentlemen in England, now abed, shall think themselves accursed they were not here, and hold their manhoods cheap, whilst any speaks that fought with us upon St. Crispin's Day!
And this was, of course, from the motion picture by Kenneth Branagh about the Battle of Agincourt. We band of brothers, we happy few. And those are sort of immortal words in English nationalism, which is quite interesting, but that's another story. Basically, the fighting commences.
Yes.
What happens?
What happens is that instead of trying to send their crossbowmen forward and their own archers forward, which would be the logical thing to do, actually, to try to win this battle, since you don't have the height disadvantage as in Crécy, they remain in the back, and the French line starts advancing. But Henry has chosen the battlefield very well. So there's a very narrow path between these two woods, and the French can only advance between them. And now when they have started the offensive, Henry has gotten what he wanted. The English longbowmen start shooting for their lives, and they shoot arrow after arrow after arrow, and
the sky
went black, basically. Since this is such a narrow stretch of land, it's very hard to miss.
And this is so strange because we say that, and I read it as well, Henry picked the battlefield well. He weren't the one to pick the battlefield. The French could have retreated. Now here's a much better battlefield where we can encircle the English archers and let's make our stand here instead. It was more or less the French who picked the battlefield.
Well, the idea of the French was not to fight there because they thought that there were actually tries of negotiation before the battle started. The French were waiting for even more troops, even though they still had a numeric advantage, which was probably considerable. They still wanted even more troops to scare Henry into submission. And Henry approached the French army, and that was quite surprising. So they never thought that they would actually fight on this field of battle.
They were just waiting.
Exactly. They were waiting for more troops. Yeah, exactly. Archers. And then Henry was surprisingly offensive.
Smart move, Henry.
Exactly. So you can say that, you can see that this is one of the main differences of Crécy. At Crécy, they're just waiting on the hill for many, many hours, and then they're just repulsing the French. Here, they're approaching the French, forcing them to attack, and then they repulse them. So what happens here is that I would say that the comparison to the First World War is even more accurate when it comes to Agincourt, because you have many men traversing a very narrow stretch of land. They take so much arrow fire. Horses are dying, men are dying, and also when some knights get through to the English lines, there is very hard fighting. There are other occasions where the French are beaten back. You get a throng, you get a huge crowding in the middle, and many of the French die from this. And there's also a lot of mud on the battlefield. Some people are partly sucked down in the mud. You have lots of corpses of both men and horses. This is a horrific situation. You also have sources claiming that the French knights, some of the French knights who were further back, started pushing through their own infantry to get forward. And then there was another crowding situation further back. This was, of course, horrific. So you also, once again, you have large numbers of men dying. Even so, the French numeric advantage was, as I said, considerable. The close combat fighting was really close. English victory was in grave doubt. I would say that this was much, much closer to breaking down than Crécy ever was. Especially since some French actually got around to attack the almost undefended English camp, but they managed to repulse them as well. In the end, the French had to pull back. They were severely beaten once again.
So this is the last and most glorious victory of a longbow on the European continent as such.
Yeah.
And the war ends.
The war ends in the Treaty of Troyes in 1420, 5 years after.
5 years after. So it sounds to me a bit like...
Hundred Years' War doesn't end, but this part of the conflict ends.
And the Hundred Years' War goes on for a bit, but we don't see another Agincourt as such.
The French start gaining more and more victories after this point.
Exactly, and sooner or later, the English kings has to give up, more or less.
Yes.
The claims to the French throne and so on and so forth. What could have changed this development? What was it that made the longbow during the Hundred Years of War? Did the French retreat to the former strategy of you know, war of attrition, or was it something else?
There are many things, many aspects that come together in this, of course, and it's still debated what the reason was, but you have several different things. First of all, the French still tried this tactic of avoiding battle. Secondly, you get more and more infantry gradually during the first half of the 15th century on the European battlefields. Shooting down approaching knights is not as efficient anymore. Then you also get the rise of gunpowder. It starts around this time, but it doesn't become dominant until the early or mid 16th century. But so you have many different things. Then you have political aspects, of course, as well, because Henry achieved his goal in a way. In the Treaty of Troyes, he is named successor to the French throne. So it looks like Anglo-France will come to pass, but both Henry and his French counterpart, Charles VI, both die 2 years after the treaty in 1422, and it basically makes the treaty void. So the English king, Henry VI, he still tries to achieve this goal, and Henry V was promised this. But Charles VII, and later French king, then defeats him, and that basically destroys the dream of a French England. So you have both political and military aspects that come together in this.
But still, the longbow survived.
Did I say a French England? I mean an English France, of course. Yeah.
Maybe you did.
Yeah.
Yeah. The longbow does survive. We still shoot the longbow today. But something happens afterwards, after the Hundred Years War, and we will talk about that in our next episode of The Sky Went Black.
Yes.
Are you satisfied with today's episode?
Yes, I think so. I think that it, in a good way, sums up the peak and the beginning of the decline of the longbow during the Hundred Years' War. But I think that, if I might just add some trivia here, I think it's interesting how some of the things that bind these two together are very specific. They are marching almost along the same paths. Calais, that is taken as a result of Crécy, is where the English are heading at Agincourt, or when they're overtaken at Agincourt. So I think that there are lots of connections between these two, and it's very neat. Usually, as a historian, you don't find this neat kind of development. And even though the French were, even though the English dream of ruling France was defeated, crushed in practice with in the mid-15th century, the English actually nominally claimed France until January 1801.
So it's a long time.
Yeah, it's and a very long time.
Napoleon came along. Thank you very much. This has been a production of Sagittari Holmia, a Stockholm company of longbow archers, which you can reach at longbows.se. And if you're Swedish listening to this, you're most welcome to join our little company of longbow
Definitely.
Archers. And above all, thank you, dear listener, for listening. And the sky went black. Tales and history of a longbow with Henrik Arnstad and Adam Westlund.